I think where we should start is kind of, if you could explain to our listeners, what is AFRICOM and what is its purpose?
Thank you for asking. It's really a landmark event, the founding of U.S. Africa Command, as it's called, and the abbreviation is AFRICOM. It achieved what the Pentagon calls initial operational capability on October the 1st, 2007, but under the auspices of U.S. European Command, EUCOM, and became fully operational, that is, independent a year later, October 1st, 2008. It's the first overseas regional military command established by the Pentagon since the Cold War. Its predecessor until then, overseas, there's actually a NORTHCOM, a Northern Command that was set up after September the 11th, 2001 for North America, which, you know, your nation is a member. But in terms of outside of North America, it's the first regional military command set up by the U.S. Defense Department since the Central Command was consolidated in 1983. So, it's a landmark in that respect alone, that it certainly suggests the priority status that the U.S. military assigns to the African continent. It is also, in terms of the amount of countries taken in, in what the Pentagon calls an area of responsibility for AFRICOM, the largest of all the U.S. Regional military commands. There's also a SOUTHCOM for the Caribbean, Central, and South America. I mentioned NORTHCOM, European Command. There's a Pacific Command. But AFRICOM takes in every nation in Africa except for Egypt, revealingly, which remains within Central Command. And now with the successful referendum in southern Sudan and the soon-to-be 54th country, 55th by some count in Africa, South Sudan, Africa Command will take in 54 full countries, which is far more than even Pacific or European Command does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty significant development. It's come on the heels, and this is something that needs to be traced back, say, a full decade. But it was born under the rubric, as I mentioned, of European Command, the chief military commander, which currently U.S. Navy Admiral James Stavridis, is simultaneously the supreme allied commander Europe for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So, it's hard to separate out U.S. European Command from NATO, and I think, I hope during the course of our discussion we'll be able to address that component
mm-hmm.
of what's going on in Africa also. But starting roughly in 2001, the Financial Times of Britain ran two fairly lengthy articles on an oil bonanza in the Gulf of Guinea, in the off the coast of Western Africa, Atlantic Ocean, and they particularly talked about a small island nation called Sao Tome and Principe, a former Portuguese possession, where there were pretty startling discoveries of oil reserves. And a decade ago, the Financial Times is reporting that the U.S. was preparing to set up a naval base on Sao Tome. And everything subsequent to that, leading up to the creation of Africa Command, in part has to be seen within the context of U.S. oil interest in West Africa, including the political turmoil in Cote d'Ivoire and Ivory Coast currently, which I think is just as significant as what's going on in Egypt right now, as well as what's going on in the Horn of Africa. So, in fact, U.S. and, in conjunction, NATO military operations in Africa really span the entire continent from the northeast to the west and, increasingly everything in between.
Mm. Now, as part of that component with AFRICOM, there's also the African Standby Force, which is quite the development in and of itself. Could you talk about that component with AFRICOM?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that also, because since the presidential runoff election results were announced in December of last year in Ivory Coast, there's been ongoing speculation about a military intervention in that country, and it would be done by what's called the West African Standby Force. The African Standby Force is nominally under the control of the African Union, whose headquarters are in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. However, it's painfully evident, and NATO officials have even commented on it, and AFRICOM, its top commander, General William Ward, has stated also, is Africa's Standby Force is a joint project of AFRICOM now, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it's envisioned to have five component parts, each corresponding to one of the regional economic communities in Africa. So that would be North, South, Central, East, and West Africa. The two that have developed the most quickly are the West African Standby Force, which is affiliated with the Economic Cooperation Organization of West African States, Nigeria, Senegal, Ghana, and others, but also what's now called the Eastern African Standby Brigade, or EASTBRIG. And the main participants in that are U.S. military client states like Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya, Ethiopia, increasingly Tanzania. And there was an article, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where the U.S. Africa Command, which is still headquartered, by the way, in Stuttgart, Germany, because no African country dare touch, the question of hosting U.S. Africa or AFRICOM headquarters because of past recollections of American military role in Africa and other American activities, covert operations in Africa. So there was a plan to divide AFRICOM into five component parts corresponding exactly to those five regional economic communities I mentioned, where the African Standby Force is the nominally, again, African Union military component. So what you see is a perfect parallel with the development of AFRICOM, which, became fully functional and independent only on October 1st, 2008. And the African Standby Force components, particularly the ones in the East and the West who have pretty much come to fruition so far, are being trained oftentimes in Europe, sometimes, officer staff and so forth in Europe by the United States and NATO, as really proxy forces, I would argue. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth recalling of, with South Sudan now becoming the newest independent nation in Africa, and Western Sahara still being under Moroccan occupation. So it's a member of the African Union, but it's not recognized as an independent state by the United States or its allies, Canada included. Of 54 countries then in Africa, divided up into five regional or into five sections or regional groupings, there are, by my count, only five nations, generally recognized nations in Africa that have more or less kept out of the grip of AFRICOM. Those five countries are, and we've talked about two of them, Libya, Ivory Coast, Eritrea, to a certain extent, Sudan, and Zimbabwe. And the Eastern African Standby Brigade is poised to strike or to intervene as needed in both Eritrea and Zimbabwe, the West African Standby Force in Ivory Coast, and then the East African Brigade also in Sudan should it be necessary. So you have now in the entire African continent and outlying island nations, a total of five countries that have basically not been subordinated to U.S. Africa Command, meaning an entire continent, of course.
Yeah, when you talk about these African standby forces, I think we should go into the specific situations in Sudan and Ivory Coast in a minute, but I'm just kind of curious, because when you read about these African standby forces, what I'm curious, though, is how many, is it all just regular troops, or are we talking also of mercenary, I guess the soft term they use is private security firms, but did those kind of forces factor into this? Because in my own reading, I know Blackwater wanted to get in and were lobbying very hard to say, look, we can go in and fix the situation in Darfur.
Oh, that's a key point. An article came out in Agence France-Presse recently, within the last 2 or 3 days, that in very recently in Somalia, in the capital city of Mogadishu, where there's, again, a nominally African Union mission called Amazon, AMISOM, African Union mission in Somalia, where recently estimates are 53 troops from Burundi and Uganda have been killed in the fighting with Al-Shabaab rebels and others, in the capital. And the Ugandan and Burundian troops that have been brought into, as belligerents, at first they're presented as peacekeepers, aren't they always, right? Iraq, Afghanistan, the Balkans, and so forth. But in fact, they're combatant forces. And in March of last year, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization began airlifting Ugandan troops into Mogadishu. There are over 2,000 airlifted in and out of the Somali capital in March of last year on a contract with DynCorp, speaking of the mercenary forms you raised. And African standby brigades initially were to consist of 5,000 troops each, so, you know, a total of 25,000. But the talk with the West African standby force is to bring it up to 15,000 troops, so, you know, pretty large contingent in, mm-hmm. in each instance, particularly in the West. I have to assume, as your question suggests, that the, you know, inevitable private contractor camp followers, if you will, are going to tag along with them. I'm also going to assume that we're not going to hear much about that.
Right, just as usual with that. So I think we should kind of start going at the look at these specific situations. Like Ivory Coast, let's go with that, because you've already raised a lot of the, some of the situation there. Essentially, is military intervention in Ivory Coast that imminent? And because I've been reading a lot about people saying, a lot of news sources basically saying that it's on the brink of a civil war, essentially, and you would need some sort of, perhaps some sort of intervention into that situation.
You know, there was a recent incident, again, within the last 48 hours or so, where six female protesters mm-hmm. in Abidjan, the commercial capital of Ivory Coast, were reported to have been shot and killed, and they're blaming the shootings on, you know, incumbent or contested president, depending on one's perspective, Laurent Gbagbo, forces, you know, having shot them. And this seems to be just the sort of, you know, humanitarian trigger that will intensify, you know, calls for a military intervention in the Ivory Coast. But this is a long story, too, that maybe sometime, some other time we'll be able to talk about. But going back to 2003, the French military intervened in what was a regional civil conflict in Ivory Coast and eventually became involved in direct conflict with government forces. And what we're seeing now is a, to date, I mean, there's been a lot of pressure placed on ECOWAS, Economic Cooperation Organization, West African States, and the West African Standby Force to intervene. Ghana, in particular, has opposed it. Nigeria, you know, also less so than Ghana, but enough to have, I think, forestalled it up until now. Hmm. But there have been recent statements, again, where the United Nations has lent itself to, Western conniving, in my estimate, where you may have seen perhaps a week or so ago, the United Nations accused the Eastern European nation of Belarus of having violated an arms embargo and sent attack helicopters to Gbagbo's forces. Decidedly the president until December, the West recognizes rather the person who ran in the runoff election against him, one Alassane Ouattara, a former International Monetary Fund employee in Washington, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was an attempt made to, I think, incite concern about Ivory Coast and to kind of tarnish two, nations on the top of the State Department's hit list, Belarus, which also had a presidential election in December, and the U.S. and the West in general contested that result. They're stating the incumbent president, Alexander Lukashenko, rigged the election and so forth. So there was a transparent attempt to link these two countries in Eastern Europe and West Africa as kind of rogue regimes. Well, the United Nations had to backtrack and apologize for the accusation, but it appears to be part of a general campaign, to mobilize international concern against the Gbagbo forces in Ivory Coast, preparatory to a military intervention. This would be done, again, with the West African Standby Force, but it would be done with the assistance of the United States and its NATO allies. You know, I should mention, by the way, ongoing at this very moment is a usually semi-annual U.S.-led, African-led military exercise in the Pan-Sahel region of Africa called Operation Flintlock. And these are special operations or special forces, with the U.S. leading it, but the countries participating are Chad, Mali, Burkina Faso, Senegal, Nigeria, and Mauritania. For the first time ever, Canada is participating. They sent special operations forces to participate with NATO allies, France, Spain, the Netherlands, and I want to say Germany. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but at least 2 years ago, Canada signed a permanent military liaison to AFRICOM headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany. And 2 years ago, the Chief of Defense of Canada, Walter Matinchik, visited AFRICOM headquarters. So there's an increased effort to pull Canada into you know, AFRICOM's activities in, on the continent.
Now, well, that's fascinating. I did not know that. I guess it's like a lot of this stuff. It's kept fairly quiet, unless you kind of know where to look, I suppose. But kind of going back to the situation in Ivory Coast, it seems to me that either choice, either you talk about the either choices of the presidential candidates, they're both sort of they both could potentially be, you know, the West's guy in Ivory Coast, right? So it seems just like they're kind of discarding Gabon and going with
they want Ouattara,
yeah,
who is a complete Western client. You know, less so a French than I would argue an American one. You know, he spent a good deal of time in Washington in two different periods, you know, working for the International Monetary Fund. In that sense, he's very comparable to the current president of Liberia, where you know, ECOWAS forces intervened earlier too, you know, a few years ago, and they've installed Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who worked in the United States for the World Bank. You know, at the end of the day, after every intervention in Western Africa, the intent of the United States and its allies is to implant or install a compliant U.S.-trained, you know, satrap.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's an interesting point, because that I think another part of it that doesn't, where that factors in also too, is Rwanda, because I believe Kagame was trained in the United States in military.
You're absolutely correct.
So yes. I mean, it's
he's a graduate of U.S. military training, and he's our favorite despot. You know,
right.
Somebody wins almost 100% of the vote, and the State Department has nothing to say about that. And whose forces, you know, were airlifted by NATO into the Darfur region in 2005. There's now talk about Rwandan troops going to Somalia. There's no question that Rwanda is one of, in many ways, the chief U.S. military client state in Africa. You know, Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, and increasingly Congo, I'm afraid, are falling into that category. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, that's a story unto itself.
Yeah, no kidding.
The U.S. And Rwanda, of course, is part of EASTBRIG, mm-hmm. East African Standby Brigade.
Yeah. So now let's talk a bit also about South Sudan, because that's a fascinating thing in itself, especially because you see this historic breaking off of South Sudan, something that's been highly contentious in the country for a long time, since its inception. So I'm kind of curious, what is sort of the strategic interest in there? Because we do know there's oil, and that seems to be a key word across the world whenever it decides where the West goes. And also, too, I think, so talk a little bit about that interest, as well as just the geography of it, because it's, if you look at it, it's very close to other client states in the area as well, South Sudan.
Yeah, I mean, South Sudan is now, will soon be, when it's officially recognized, the world's newest nation. In terms of universally recognized nations, it's the newest since Montenegro in 2006. Kosovo still not being recognized by a handy majority of countries in the world. South Sudan, you're right. I mean, it's right in the area bordering Uganda, Kenya, and Ethiopia. There have been substantiated reports of major oil findings precisely in that area, and their plans for pipelines to move oil, you know, through Uganda and Kenya to the Indian Ocean and so forth. So, you know, it'd be a nice little catch. I think we have to see this also in context of competition with China in particular and Russia for energy contracts and so forth in Africa. And, you know, another argument for the creation of AFRICOM was exactly that, you know, kind of mark off the continent as American territory and let nations like China and Russia in the first instances know who's in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think South Sudan fits into that territory. Also, you know, the question of autonomous, semi-autonomous regions in the Horn of the general Horn of Africa region is one that's been exploited, you know, by the West. They're, you know, a semi-autonomous area in Somalia called Puntland, and there is a basically secessionist entity called Somaliland. NATO warships, you know, regularly visit Puntland, and, you know, for the what's called Operation Ocean Shield, which is an ongoing naval operation by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in the Gulf of Aden off the Horn of Africa. So I there was an article actually about 2 weeks ago in the African press suggesting the East African Standby Force, or EASTBRIG, would soon be exercising in South Sudan. So, I mean, they didn't even let the ink dry on, you know, whatever documents certify the referendum results, you know, before there's talk already about moving a, you know, basically AFRICOM-controlled military entity into South Sudan for you know, joint military exercises. In other words, to integrate South Sudan into the general AFRICOM system.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Now, what is the possibility, too, of once... It seems to be going, I guess, more peaceful in South Sudan in that situation than I think a lot of people would have thought.
I sincerely hope so, but there has been fighting, internal fighting.
Oh, yes, yes.
South Sudan, fairly deadly.
Yeah.
You know, something else that I think is worth, since, you know, you raised the general Horn of Africa region, you know, since 2001, actually the agreement was reached months before September the 11th, 2001, to have U.S. military forces stationed at a foreign, former French Foreign Legion base in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa called Camp Le Manier. And, you know, U.S. military forces from all major branches of U.S. Armed Forces, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines, have been stationed there now for 10 years, almost 10 years. And there's something called Combined Task Force Horn of Africa, Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, which takes in the general, what we understand to be the Horn of Africa region, Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Sudan, but which also includes you know, Kenya and Tanzania, Uganda, and increasingly the four island nations off the coast of eastern Africa, Seychelles, Mauritius, Madagascar, and Comoros. But also takes in, revealingly enough, the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, Yemen.
Huh.
So, you know, there's a broad region there stretching from Uganda to Yemen, from Djibouti to Kenya, that the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, which initially, by the way, was set up under the auspices of Operation Enduring Freedom.
Oh.
You know, part of the general Afghan war campaign, which takes in 14 nations. And, you know, was later ceded to Africa. And similarly, when we talked about Operation Flintlock, which is going on right now in the Sahel region, that grew out of a State Department initiative called the Pan-Sahel Initiative, which is now referred to as the Trans-Saharan or Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership, which grew out of Operation Enduring Freedom Pan-Sahel. So after 9/11 of 2001, I mean, the U.S. not only invaded Afghanistan with its British and later NATO allies, but extended that operation on both sides of Africa.
Now, keeping with South Sudan, I've been reading reports of... I read a report of a couple years ago, essentially... there was a shipment of arms, I think it was originally from the Ukraine, that was destined for South Sudan. And
tanks, as I recall. No?
Pardon? Tanks?
Including tanks.
Yeah, I think it was
heavy,
30-something...
armored vehicles.
And I believe the story one is that Somali pirates intercepted that shipment, and that's kind of how this whole... how it all this particular incident came about, because then all these Somali pirates were saying, look, we got all these weapons, we'll ransom this. I'm sure you guys probably want this stuff back. Has the West kind of been really arming South Sudan for the last little while? Because it seems like there has been...
That's a very incisive observation. I had forgotten about that. I can't say, but that I would certainly share your suspicion that that was a major part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, when the original Organization of African Unity was set up, which is now the African Union, its constitution, as that of the AU, was very explicit in, condemning the secessionist movements in new African states, precisely because of the colonial past. I mean, the borders were oftentimes drawn rather arbitrarily, depending on where the French met up with the British or where the Germans met up with the Dutch or, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, Africa would be a tinderbox. Secessionist movements were allowed to erupt based on ethnic, tribal, religious, and other differences. And, as a result, the African nations themselves, and collectively now in the African Union, have tended to discourage those events. The South Sudan or Southern Sudan, of course, has quite a history, and it goes back 30 or more years, where there was initially a left-wing, liberation movement. But in the post-Cold War period, you need a new scorecard, right, Scott? What made sense during the Cold War doesn't necessarily make sense right now. The fact that Angola, which fought a war of... it was granted independence in essence by Portugal, but fought a war against apartheid South Africa, which was backed mm-hmm. by the United States in 1974 and 75, is now the sixth major exporter of oil to the United States.
Mm.
Another thing, perhaps we can talk about the Africa Partnership Station, where U.S. Guided missile warships and others, have visited every coastal nation in Africa, with the exception of Ivory Coast. Over the past two or three years, and including Mozambique. If you can imagine U.S. warships in Mozambique,
yeah.
or U.S. military in Angola, this is something during the Cold War would have been inconceivable. Now it's a matter of course.
I mean, that's kind of almost the sad thing about all this, is that if you really want to get in, really, really want to get into all these issues, I mean, you have to go back to almost the colonial period where all this stuff really starts.
That's correct.
Right. I
always point out that with the involvement of the North with NATO in Africa, you are talking about a consortium of all the major European colonial past masters, aren't you? I mean, France, England, Portugal, Spain, Turkey, Germany, Italy, and then the would-be neo-colonial master of the continent, the United States, and this is the condominium, if you will, of Western colonial powers and so forth gathered together to, in a new scramble for Africa,
mm-hmm.
in a very real sense, redominating the continent after the brave and liberation struggles of the 1960s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. You touched on it, just what you were last talking about was the military involvement, but talk a bit more about the base in Djibouti, because that's kind of the main foothold on the continent, is it not?
Yeah, you're correct. I mean, it's the only, permanent acknowledged U.S. military base in Africa. Though about 2 years ago, the U.S. opened an installation on the island nation of Seychelles, where they stationed Reaper drones and helicopters, and slightly over 100 U.S. military personnel to man them. And they're, I think pretty incontestably, they're U.S. base camps and, other smaller military facilities in nations like Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Congo now, Mali in West Africa. But Djibouti, you're correct, is the major one, because they're in the area of 2,000 U.S. military forces, including naval. I mean, major warships can dock in Djibouti harbor. Mm-hmm. And operating out of Djibouti, the U.S. has conducted, bombings and other military operations in both Somalia and Yemen. So that's, as you indicate, that's clearly the regional hub.
Mm-hmm.
And an article appeared actually substantiation of reports appeared roughly a year ago that France also maintains its what's reported to be its largest overseas military base currently in Djibouti, with 3,000 troops. The U.S. has 2,000 or more troops. There have also been military personnel from Germany, Britain, and you know, other NATO members stationed in Djibouti. But roughly a year ago, it was announced that Japan is going to open its first overseas military base since World War II in Djibouti. Hmm. And you know, Robert Gates, the defense secretary, was in Japan in last December, and I can't remember his exact words, but he stated in so many words that the United States and Japan have a strategic military partnership not only in Far East Asia but internationally. Hmm. And the fact that Japan is opening you know, a military base in moving into a military base in Djibouti is an indication that the integration of the U.S. and its military allies around the world is not limited to NATO allies, but also includes, you know, what in the last 5 or 6 years has been referred to as Asian NATO, India being another major partner in that. And, you know, there are a number of combined task force, maritime or naval combined task force operating throughout the entire region, the North Arabian Sea, under control of the U.S., but with the participation of Australia, you know, India, Pakistan, and other Asia-Pacific countries, Japan, you know, as well as European NATO nations.
Let's move on to Libya, because that's something that's been in the news a lot. And so what's the... Is military action there imminent, or are they just... Are we just going to look at like kind of no-fly zones, or what's the situation here of intervention into Libya?
Yeah, I wish I could answer that definitively. I can tell you what we both know, which is two U.S. warships, USS Kearsarge, which is an amphibious assault ship capable of carrying as many as 2,000 Marines and helicopters, and USS Ponce have just left the Ceuta Bay naval base in Crete, the island nation, part of Greece in the eastern Mediterranean, heading by all accounts towards the Libyan coast. We also have heard reports, as I'm sure all of us, that from yesterday that eight British SAS special forces were captured by rebel forces in Libya. So there's, and there have been reports that French as well as American special forces have already moved into eastern Libya. It's a good question, but I think that the, you know, looking at how warships, warplanes, and so forth are being positioned right now, you know, there's certainly an indication that there's going to be military action in Libya. I think it's worth noting. I mean, the U.S. Sixth Fleet is based not too right across the Mediterranean from Libya in Italy. That's one of six global naval fleets the U.S. maintains to patrol, you know, all the major seas and all the oceans of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You also have, since 2001, you know, incidentally, the United NATO supported the invasion and the subsequent war in Afghanistan based on activating for the first and to date only time Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, the founding document of NATO, which states that an attack against one member, you know, is viewed as an attack against all, and the others are obligated to, you know, provide support. But another part of that activation of Article 5 was NATO launching something called Operation Active Endeavor in the Mediterranean Sea, which operates to this day.
Hmm.
And that's a fairly comprehensive naval surveillance and interdiction effort. In essence, NATO tracks and can stop at its will any vessel coming into and out of the Mediterranean Sea, you know, from the Strait of Gibraltar to the Suez Canal to the Bosporus. So you have naval... NATO military forces as well as U.S. Sixth Fleet permanently stationed in the Mediterranean, you know, able to respond. It's also, I think, an important point that of all the North African nations bordering the Mediterranean Sea, Libya is the only one that is not a member of NATO's Mediterranean Dialogue Partnership Program.
Hmm.
You know, the four others, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Egypt are. So one consequence of a U.S. or U.S.-NATO invasion of Libya that installs a friendly government, in Western terms, would be the incorporation of Libya, you know, into that NATO partnership.
But you just mentioned about a friendly government. I mean,
yeah, that's meant to be dripping with irony.
Yeah. I mean, because the point I was getting at was that relations with Gaddafi recently in the George Bush era has started to normalize a bit, and he kind of became someone who they could do business with. But it seems that, and the same thing, I guess, with Mubarak, and I mean, you could go down the whole list of the history of the African continent, but is it just another case of a disposable dictator that they, you know, they just go, well, someone else new is coming in, get rid of him, put in the new guy that'll be our guy, right?
That would have to be my guess. And there are precedents for this, too. It's not only Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak in Egypt. Let's go back to 2003. I mean, Edward Shevardnadze, the president of Georgia, was as compliant and loyal an ally as the United States could have wished for, but that didn't prevent the U.S. covertly, for the most part, supporting what was called the Rose Revolution, which is really the prototype for a lot of these regime change transformations that have occurred. And the U.S. would have no objection, as you say, to throwing a decades-old ally to the wolves if it could achieve broader geopolitical and military objectives in the region. You're right about, you know, Libya seeking a rapprochement with the United States and the West as a whole. My personal supposition has always been in large part because they were afraid after 9/11. And seeing what treatment was dished out to Iraq and assuming they could be next, I think, you know, probably made the Egyptian government, or the Libyan government, rather, probably made a lot of concessions they would not have made ordinarily. There was even one incident a couple, 3 years ago where one or more Libyan naval vessels participated in a NATO exercise in the Mediterranean. So, on the other hand, Libya is one of those five nations I've mentioned that up until now has been not totally incorporated into, AFRICOM's plans for the continent.
Right.
I mean, you can be 99% compliant, but evidently if you're not 100% so, then you're disposable.
I guess with all this, I mean, when anyone starts to kind of speak out against this sort of, it seems like it's this, I mean, we're just talking about the one continent, but you've also alluded to things going on in Asia and in the Middle East as well. It seems when everyone sort of wants to challenge this thing of this kind of, this global military expansion, that sometimes the argument is, well, like, what, would you rather have Russia or China doing the same thing? So I put that question to you, is that, well, is this really all that bad? I mean, or would it be better, would you rather have China or Russia doing this and kind of spreading their hands across the globe?
Well, I mean, easy answer to that one. China has no military bases overseas. Russia has, a small contingent of troops in, what are called frozen conflict areas in the former Soviet Union, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Transnistria. Very small contingent in Armenia, but aside from that, they really have no troops outside of what was formerly Russia, as well as the Soviet Union. So it's not a question of, several nations or blocks of nations competing for Africa. It's the fact that one nation, the United States, has set up a comprehensive military command to subordinate the entire continent. I don't think in response to the intrusions of other countries, this is to preempt economic and other arrangements that, countries far larger than the United States, like China and India and so forth, might choose to do. It's achieving dominance. There was several years ago in the Chinese press, there was an analysis of AFRICOM before it was actually launched, and it stated that, detailing American plans, particularly for North Africa at the time, stated that achieving what the U.S. plans to do with AFRICOM, the U.S. would, and I'm quoting the Chinese author, seize the helm of the world. And I think if we look at what's, as you mentioned, the international connections, a former State Department official who, at the time he made the comment I'm going to cite to you, was U.S. permanent representative to NATO, that is, Ambassador to NATO, Nicholas Burns, made a statement in 2004 were, you know, in so many words, Europe has been taken care of. It's been taken care of through NATO expansion and so forth. And now we have to look to the east and the south. Mm-hmm. Well, the south is Africa. The east is the South Caucasus, Central Asia, Caspian Sea Basin, South Asia. And the, you know, the southeast is the Horn of Africa and so forth, the Middle East. So I think, you know, it's pretty clear that with U.S. military, U.S. dominated military bloc NATO, incorporating every single country in Europe, either as a full member or as a partner, the one standout until a week and a half ago was the small island nation of Cyprus, whose parliament late last month, you know, voted to join NATO's Partnership for Peace movement. That the U.S. has now moved on from Europe to Africa and from Africa to the Middle East and Asia. I should add that, you know, we mentioned earlier that the chief military commander of U.S. European Command is also NATO's Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. And several years ago, the man occupying both posts was Marine General James Jones, you know, subsequently went on to become the Obama administration's first national security advisor. But he made statements, you know, early in this century, I can't say decade anymore, but in the early 10 or so years ago, said there are two areas where oil exploitation has not been maximized, and he talked about West Africa's Gulf of Guinea and the Caspian Sea.
Hmm.
So, you know, in a way, just as with the quote of Nicholas Burns I cited earlier, you know, an attentive reading of what these people tell you gives you an indication of what they're going to do. They'll do it under false pretenses, but, you know, having warned sometimes a decade in advance what it is they covet and where it is, I think we shouldn't be surprised when they move into those areas exactly.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it seems, to wrap everything up, is it seems that the next theater for this, I'm sure it'll be put under the auspices of the War on Terror, but it seems the next theater will be Africa.
You know, a couple things in Africa. I mean, not only has the U.S. established its first overseas regional military command in, what would that be, 24 years, 25 years with the full activation, but, you know, Africa recently exceeded a billion people in terms of population, making it the second most populous continent in the world. It's vitally important for a number of reasons, you know, natural resources being a key one, human resources being a key one. And there's no question but that with Europe now considered safe, you know, to the empire builders in Washington and London and Brussels, and the Middle East pretty much neutralized, if nothing else, that the move would come on Africa. You know, periodically, AFRICOM Commander William Ward will state, the last time I heard him, I think it was that AFRICOM had direct bilateral military relations with 35 African nations. I think that number is probably up, you know, to close to 50 now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to say at this point, politically and militarily, the U.S. feels it's more or less subjugated. Europe under NATO is doing something comparable or has achieved it already in Africa. And, you know, the last part of the world, two parts of the world that haven't been subjugated are Latin America and Asia.